Joining us on WRCO's morning show, we have Dr. Andrew Wright from the Richland Hospital to talk about the upcoming seasons and certainly talking about some vaccinations and things like that. I guess 'tis the season, Dr. Wright. Good morning.
Good morning, yes.
Good to have you in here with us. Respiratory season, the virus season coming up. I guess we want to talk about why vaccinations are an important thing.
Yes, well, the season's already begun. We're seeing, obviously, the sniffles and colds. And so the ones that we can action on for vaccines include influenza, COVID-19, and then RSV, depending on, you know, the population you're in, we can go through that. So for influenza, you know, why vaccinate? It's about a 5% hospitalization rate for influenza, which is pretty high. And that is taken from a study of 1 billion people. Where about 5 million were then hospitalized. I think I got my math right on that. Nope, 0.5%. There we go. And those hospitalizations can be serious. We get them every year. Usually that's going to be either children under 2, particularly children under 1, or people older than 65. That's who generally gets hospitalized. RSV, similar, almost identical in terms of hospitalizations, usually younger children under a year. And then people older than 65, 70. COVID has changed because most of us have immunity because it's been around. Clearly, it's not as deadly as it was when it first came out in 2020. So that being said, there's still some risk, and we can go over percentages in terms of how the vaccine can help and in what way and for who. Yeah.
I guess we kind of categorize everything as the flu. Lots of times.
Yeah, we do.
How do we differentiate those?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah. So, and sometimes when people say the flu, they mean a stomach or a intestinal inflammation, which we sometimes call the stomach flu. And so influenza is primarily a respiratory disease. How do you differentiate it, say, from the common cold? Well, it can be difficult. There are some things that help, though. There are sometimes GI symptoms. Both COVID and influenza can give you some diarrhea. That would be a differentiator from the cold. Cold doesn't really do that, like rhinovirus, coronavirus. The non-COVID coronaviruses don't do that. Another way to differentiate is high fever, especially if your immune system is robust and you get a high fever. That's not common with the common cold. You generally don't see that. And then the other one is common colds settle usually in the upper respiratory tract, so like the nose, the throat. Some people will get a very sore throat for a day or two and they think, oh no, I have strep. If they give it a day or two and if it gets better, it's more likely a cold virus. Whereas influenza is going to go quickly into the lower respiratory tract, so in the lungs, similar with COVID and RSV.
Yeah, RSV, could you describe what that is?
So respiratory syncytial virus. And so for people over 65, 70, for kids under 1 year old, the reason it's so leads to such a high rate of hospitalizations is it produces a tremendous amount of mucus. It induces the cells in the lung lining to produce a tremendous amount of mucus. Well, if there's mucus, then your oxygen exchange isn't as good, and so you end up with low oxygen. We don't have any approved antiviral treatments for it. So when someone needs to be hospitalized, you're supporting them with supplemental oxygen. Occasionally, you can use epinephrine. Occasionally, that will be helpful. That's about it. Steroids haven't shown a role for RSV. So what do you do? We now have, over the past 5 years, we've developed a prevention strategy. And so the target populations for the RSV vaccine would be children under 8 months old, pregnant moms to give immunity to their children. And that the ideal window there is 32 to 36 weeks pregnant. And the time this vaccine happens then is going to be September through March through the season. And then it's also recommended for people over 75 because their risk is higher. And then if someone were, say, immunocompromised, say they've had a kidney transplant in the age group from 50 to 74, they'll also benefit and have reduced hospitalization. What we're trying to prevent with all of these vaccines is hospitalization. And obviously, dying. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. School is back in session now as well, and you know, I guess as a parent, sometimes it's hard to. Is it a sniffle? Is it when should we see a physician or consult?
So I would say that in general, if someone is still eating, drinking, they're not struggling to breathe, wait it out a day or two. I would say for young children under 2, if you get temperature 100.4 or higher, greater than 48 hours, or any signs of respiratory distress, right? A good way to check a baby for respiratory distress is to check their breathing rate when they're sleeping, right? So if you have a child, say, under 6 months of age, and that respiratory rate is 50 to 60 respirations per minute when they're sleeping, that could be pneumonia. That could be something more serious. And then if you're getting a little older, if it's above 40, that could still be pneumonia. So those are times to get concerned. Fever and high respiratory rate, and just, you know, if they can't eat and drink, get them in. Yeah.
What about the pneumonia vaccine?
Yeah, so the pneumococcal vaccine, this is a common misconception. It is for invasive pneumococcal disease. So what's invasive pneumococcal disease? That means meningitis. It means endocarditis. It means epidural abscess. So it doesn't necessarily, it has a small effect on reducing pneumonia due to pneumococcus, but its bigger role is to prevent these other more invasive diseases. That's what it's for.
Okay.
And that is recommended now 50 and older, basically. And then if someone's younger than 50 and has a compelling reason, say they have bad asthma, COPD, diabetes, immunocompromised from transplant or rheumatoid or other autoimmune diseases, those are the people who get that one.
Is that a yearly shot?
No, it is not. So depending on the population, it can be every 5 years until 65, then one after. With the newer ones cover the... These bacteria have different coats, if you will, different disguises. And so you want to cover a number of those disguises. That's why you'll see, you know, now we use the PCV21 or the PCV20. The C refers to conjugate vaccine. It's attached to something else. There used to be a PSSV, and that was a polysaccharide sugar attached vaccine. We don't use that one anymore. And then after 65, it's just one. Yeah, I think that's all I can say about that one.
What are some common misconceptions you hear from patients about vaccines?
Well, the main one is, this puzzles me, Phil, is they don't trust the science, right? In other words, they don't trust how efficacious they are. So I wanted to run through those numbers. So that's the biggest thing. You know, how much will this help? I hear that, you know, does the flu vaccine do anything? Because it's not a perfect match, and we'll go through that here shortly. And then people are skeptical, or not skeptical, or afraid of the mRNA technology. mRNA refers to messenger RNA. Just a quick review, the cells in the nucleus is DNA, and that then gets transcribed to RNA, which then comes out of the nucleus into the main part of the cell where the factory to make proteins is. And so that RNA then makes the proteins we need to protect ourselves, to build cells, to build muscles, things proteins do. And so an mRNA vaccine is you're injecting mRNA into the bloodstream, which then goes into the white blood cells, which then codes for the proteins we need. For example, the COVID vaccine coded for spike protein, which was one of the proteins that would attach to our cells, invade our cells, cause the COVID disease. That's how they work. People were thinking it would change their genetic code. It actually doesn't go to the nucleus, so it does not change genetic code because it doesn't go there. It doesn't go where the genetic code is stored. It just goes into the main cell where the factories to make proteins are. And it's very interesting because we have you've maybe seen in the news lately, we have a new vaccine for pancreatic cancer. That's an mRNA vaccine. I would be willing to bet that anyone with pancreatic cancer that has the genetic signature that would benefit from that vaccine is going to take it. Meaning sometimes we have these ideological ideas, but when the rubber hits the road, we're going to use something that helps. And I do have confidence in people that they ultimately will trust the science. You know, we trust the science for, say, the nutrition we feed our cattle to, you know, and we get new recommendations on how to change that to improve, you know, your milk yield or the quality of your beef. Why would we not trust the science on vaccines, which is, you know, studied in exactly the same way nutrition science is studied?
Yeah, recently, so, yeah. Measles have been in the news a lot more than ever before.
Yeah, right. So, and that's a direct result of decreased vaccination of measles. Canada has already lost their eradication title. This is confusing to many people. You can have measles cases and still say it's eradicated. There's a certain threshold number. We're probably going to lose that title of eradication, and that has to do with protecting larger communities. So I can just give you There is a reliable, but you can still go to the CDC. It's been politicized a little bit, meaning, for example, there were two recent deaths in New York, both caused by the measles, both initially listed as not caused by the measles until some reporters investigated. One was a child under a year old, clearly died from complications of the measles. Another one was an older adult. Those are the two vulnerable populations, again, who died of a measles pneumonia. But it was listed as pneumonia, and they didn't, but they ultimately did. So in Wisconsin, the better thing is you go to the CDC website on measles, just Google CDC measles, and then you can go to, Wisconsin keeps a robust state database. So in 2026, we have had 144 cases. I just checked it today. 143 of those cases are in unvaccinated individuals. Two measles vaccines gives you 97% chance of not getting the measles. One measles vaccine gives you somewhere around 92 to 95% chance of not getting the measles. It's a highly effective vaccine.
How do you know, like, let's say you don't know where your records are, you know, how do you know whether you had it?
That's a good question, too. So you have a couple options there. Let's say you're an adult, come to clinic. I've had this lately over the past few weeks because, you know, our adjacent counties have had quite a few cases, Grant and Iowa County. And so, you know, it's just a matter of time before we get more cases here in Richland County. We have a contingency plan at the hospital about how to isolate and diagnose this. This is the most contagious respiratory virus. And it's one of the ones that's more severe. So, you know, one in a thousand about people who get measles will die, regardless of the care they get. So the game is to prevent them from getting measles in the first place. Hospitalization rates vary. So, for example, in Wisconsin, of those 144 cases, we had four hospitalizations, zero deaths. The vaccine works. That's all I can tell you. It dramatically, if you look nationwide, the trend we see in Wisconsin is true. About 99% of the people getting the measles now are unvaccinated.
So those vaccines, I think the thing is that, you know, childhood vaccines, people are trying to, you know, protect their children in some ways, right?
Well, I've always said that people who vaccinate and people who don't vaccinate have the same goal of protecting their children.
Yeah.
That we share in common. And it's just, how do I accomplish that? I think some folks are willing to accept the risk of this, you know, severe disease being rare, right? So the two main complications from measles are going to be severe pneumonia. And then there's both an immediate and delayed inflammation of the brain that can happen. The delayed one's dreaded because, again, that's preventable. We don't know who's going to get that, and it happens several months later, and it's devastating, obviously, because it often leads to death. But, you know, you're talking about a 1 in 1,000 chance. Some people are willing to take that. On a population basis, why would anyone, you know, if you think about, you've got, let's do some quick math here. So if you've got a million people, that means 1,000 of them will die if none of them are vaccinated. Well, that seems like a big number to me. You know, seems unnecessary.
Right.
Yeah.
When should we start be thinking about getting vaccinated for COVID or for flu or whatever?
That's a good question, too. So the influenza vaccine has sort of peak immunity for about 4 months. Both vaccines take about 2 weeks to take effect. You can get them together. You can get them with RSV at the same time as well. So if you think the influenza season generally runs from sort of Thanksgiving through the end of April, you get about 6 months of coverage from the vaccine. So I usually counsel people late October is, or early, very early November is the sweet spot. I know they start rolling them out at the end of August. Last year, as a hospitalist, I had a few cases where people vaccinated in early September. These are people over 75, were hospitalized for influenza B in April, meaning I think there's a value in not getting the vaccine too early. Obviously, there's a value in not getting it too late. Yeah.
But if you're worried about a gathering at Thanksgiving, which would be a couple of weeks.
You need at least 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
2 weeks prior, you'll have your immunity.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's good to know. And some people get, sometimes they get a little bit ill after the flu shot, right?
That's true, yes. And I think that actually, Phil, that's an impediment. People say, we hear this a lot. I'm not getting the flu vaccine because I got the flu from the flu vaccine. It is not a live vaccine. There's a live intranasal one, but most people don't get that. So in general, it's not a live vaccine. And so it cannot give you the flu, but it can give you a reaction, right? So there's two reasons for the reaction. One is it's your body's immune system ramping up. In the flu vaccine, it's either called the trivalent or the quadrivalent. It is against the two most significant proteins of the flu virus that they use to break through into our cells, namely hemagglutinin and neuraminidase. That's why you'll see H and N and different types, H1, H2, and 1 and 2. And so it's a bit of a guessing game, right? And then several months prior, because we're growing these in culture, and sometimes those are on eggs, we're growing them, we're trying to match that. And so that's the immunity we want to get. I forgot your question.
About the flu shot, about getting sick.
Correct. Yeah. So the one thing is your body's reaction, right? You're ramping up an immune response, and that can make you, that releases pro-inflammatory markers, sort of boosters to get an immune response. That discomfort usually is a day or two for most people. They can take some Tylenol or rest, and they're through it. The other one is a reaction to some of the reagents in the vaccine. We do not use mercury in vaccines anymore. That's not there. That hasn't been for a while. These are mostly preservative-free vaccines. I think the only ones we stock are preservative-free. But you could react to some other vehicle that's in there, and that can lead to a robust local reaction. In very rare cases, you can get a very serious condition called Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is very serious. And that can happen with any vaccine. That's not unique to the flu vaccine or RSV vaccine. And that is loss of motor neuron function, usually ascending from the lower extremities. Not always completely resolving, right? So there'll be a percentage of weakness. How common is that? It's not common at all. Have I seen it? I have.
Interesting. And then in terms of flu shots and getting the flu, some people probably will say, well, I'll take my chances or whatever.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean.
Okay. So if you're kind of in that group, that's where I wanted to just pull out some statistics here, because this will help people. I'm just going to give the percentages, right? So you can decide whether you want to take your chances or not. So targeting high risk populations. So in adults over 65, you can reduce your hospitalization rate by somewhere around 30-40%. For people 6 months to 17 years old, you can reduce your chance of dying by 20%. But keep in mind, dying is a rare rare event with flu. But you reduce it by 20%. You reduce all severe flu by 20 to 30, more like 30%. You reduce symptomatic disease in kids under one by about 60%. So that's a pretty big impact. The youngest, so there's this strong recommendation for influenza vaccine for 6 months to 23 months, especially because they're more vulnerable to more severe disease. And then all-comer hospitalization in older adults is reduced by 60%. So those are the kind of benefits we get. When people say, how effective is the flu vaccine? In general, if you look at a 10-year cohort, it reduces the risk of disease and death by 40%. That's the short answer. Last year was not a perfect match. It's never a perfect match, but it was a little worse than usual. It reduced it by about 33%. 2023, so the 2025 vaccine was slightly less effective. 2023 was a really good year. We were almost 60%. But if you take 10 years, it's about 40% reduction.
Yeah, that's a pretty high number, though.
I think it's a pretty high number. And the other thing you're talking about is you're talking about lost work days, lost days in school. If your child is home from school, that means you might be home from work. So those are the other benefits besides the more serious ones.
Yeah. What's the latest on the COVID-19 recommendations, Dr.?
Yeah, so there's actually been some movement on that. I just read to you was influenza vaccine effectiveness and safety for 26-27, and that was a JAMA special communication just put out September 2nd. This also just put out September 2nd was effectiveness of the COVID vaccine. And so again, I'll give you the numbers here. So let's start with who is most at risk. So the IDSA, which is the Infectious Disease Society of America, has really focused on the immunocompromised. So they're saying essentially anybody who's had a transplant, anybody on these rheumatologic drugs, these autoimmune drugs to suppress your immune system, get the COVID-19 vaccine. Because already they don't mount as good a response, and we have robust data to prevent hospitalization and death for that group. In fact, the data is most robust for that group. And so that's why they've confined it to that recommendation. We know there's community immunity, right? So here's currently what can the vaccine do? The other high-risk groups are older than 65. And then anybody, you can think of it, what does COVID-19 do to us? It causes mini clots, right? So anybody at risk of mini clots and the dangers of mini clots, so older than 65, obese, sleep apnea, diabetes, hypertension, these are people who are at higher risk of mini clots. What does a mini clot cause? Well, a mini clot can cause a stroke. A mini clot can cause a pulmonary embolism. A mini clot can cause a heart attack. I have seen all three of those complications from getting COVID. So even though we're not seeing these respiratory inflammation and death, which is great, right? Because, you know, COVID just doesn't, quite frankly, doesn't kill people the way it used to, thank God. We're still seeing these complications from clotting. And then the American College of Cardiology also points out, for people at increased risk of getting atrial fibrillation, that inflammation from COVID also increases the risk of getting atrial fibrillation. So who's at risk for atrial fibrillation? Obese, sleep apnea, hypertension, heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, people who drink alcohol too much. So those are people who should think about it. But here's the benefits by the numbers. So greater than 65 reduces the risk of hospitalization by half. So that population still gets a benefit. For pregnant women, it reduces the risk of going to urgent care by 40%. So take that as you would. And then if mom gets the vaccine, it cuts the risk of hospitalization for the baby by 50%. Keep in mind, though, that hospitalization rates for COVID for babies is low. It also, the biggest benefit for that 9-month to 4-year-old is reduction in emergency room visits by 25%. So you can see that the benefit to the 65 and older is much higher than the benefit to these other groups, but there are those small. Here's the big one. Reduction of 50% in death with immunocompromised people. That's why IDSA is focusing on that group continuing to get the COVID-19 vaccine. Also keep in mind that having had COVID within the last year gives you the same immunity as the vaccine. And for people who've had COVID multiple times or have had multiple vaccines, particularly more than two, they have pretty good immunity.
Hmm. I know when the shot first came out, people were talking about young people dying. You know, I'm sure you probably
heard
that.
So there was a few high profile cases in teenagers of inflammation of the heart muscle. COVID itself causes inflammation of the heart muscle at a slightly higher rate than the vaccine did in that group. So teenage boys more than girls. However, if a person were to separate out the first and second vaccine, let's say this is when they have no immunity whatsoever, you reduce that risk of heart muscle inflammation. Instead of going 2 months, if you went 3 to 5 months, you reduce it to almost nothing. But yeah, there were a few high profile cases. So although rare, yes, that was a complication of the vaccine in that age group. You know, and then you notice I didn't list any significant benefits for that age group in getting the vaccine. So you have to kind of take it as it was. I did see one case of severe global immune inflammation. So SCID, or not immune compromised. I can't remember the acronym for it. But I did see a case of that where a young man aged 11 got two COVID cases in a row, and so so we recognized it, sent him off to Children's, he got the treatment, he did fine, and so the vaccine would have helped him in that case. Those are rare cases, but there are these rare severe complications of the of the disease.
Are there new medicines that you can do to maybe reduce the effects of COVID once you have it then? Have they made some
There's a brand new antiviral out, so we have the Paxlovid, right? And again, it's not recommended for someone who is under 65, you know, over four who's healthy to use this antiviral. But unless you're around someone who's immunocompromised, then you should take it. And then you can give prophylaxis to the people who are exposed. So this new one, I am blanking on the name, but I just read this the other day. It's an antiviral. It's for contacts and people who have it. And it is slightly better at reducing the illness and preventing you from getting it than Paxlovid. So we'll see that on the shelves. The current price tag for that five-day course is $1,400. So I don't think the uptake's going to be too high until that price comes down.
My goodness.
Yeah.
What can we do to help and benefit our immune system?
Well, that's good. Yeah. So there are definitely some, you know, we don't have rigorous studies, but we know certain things help. We know that garlic helps cell-mediated immunity. We know that. And so that is something a person can have. The jury is still out on vitamin C and high-dose vitamin C. There doesn't seem to be any harm. We don't know the benefits. A lot of us use it and seems to shorten a viral illness, but we don't have robust data to support that. This might make people sad, but there's no data for echinacea having any significant benefit.
Really?
So, yeah. I mean, go ahead and take it. There's no harm. But, you know, yeah. And then similarly for elderberry is another one you sometimes see. Yeah.
I've taken some of the over-counter things when I start to feel a cold coming on, you know.
Yeah.
And maybe it's a placebo, but sometimes it does seem like it's shortening it.
It's well worth it in those cases, especially when we know there's no harm.
Dr. Wright, is there any place where people can look for good information?
Yes. I mean, there are several, I would say, reliable sources. I have to say right now the CDC is in flux and several medical organizations such as the American Academy of Family Physicians, American Academy of Pediatricians, and the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists and IDSA have come out with their own recommendations. But I don't expect people to go to all those different sites. But there is a good site that sort of acts as a clearinghouse for these. It's a nonprofit. It's called the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. And they have sort of an evidence-based vaccine section. So that's www.nfid.org.
Well, we've talked about some pretty tough subjects here today. What kind of music are you listening to these days, Dr. Wright?
Let's see. Well, I always listen to a little bit of bluegrass.
Really?
And Americana. Yes. And then my colleague at work got me listening to Olivia Dean, which I really enjoy her music.
Wonderful.
Yeah, so all over the board. And then always classical music. I have exchanged listening to the news in the morning for classical music for the past year, and I think that's probably helped more than anything.
I think so, too. Well, I think sometimes, you know, as far as our mental health, too, we need that little three-minute escape once in a while.
Well,
we?
And relative to our immune systems, we know that, you know, there's studies on this. Taking a walk in nature will boost your immune system. Getting the sleep you need, there is no replacement for good sleep in terms of the strength it gives to our immune system.
Sure.
Yeah.
Maybe listening to a country song and you know, you respond by drinking alcohol. Alcohol doesn't necessarily help the immune system either, does it?
Right. So the key is to listen to that country song and maybe have an NA beer.
Sounds good, Dr. Wright. As always, good to see you. And here's to a healthy
Thanks,
season.
Phil. You yeah, bet. Appreciate it.
Dr. Andrew Wright joining us on this portion of the morning show.